capitalist nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India, as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protests through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least €20 billion for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the Eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The people providing the nation with care, asking to be looked after by the authorities. Some of the tens of thousands of UK nurses who have walked off their jobs demanding better pay and conditions. Lakshmi has worked for the NHS for 22 years.
Shortages of nurses have led to less staff, and you can't care for people if you don't have a staff to care for. So it's person safety. Mainly, and if here comes, obviously, people are leaving profession due to, unfair pays, overworked, stressed, and shortage of staff.
Hailed as heroes during the pandemic, nurses up and down the country, Save Scotland, are staging two 12-hour strikes this week and next. Their representative body, the Royal College of Nursing, says they had no choice when the government rejected calls for talks on NHS pay. The RCN says nurses are 20% worse off in real terms today than they were in 2010 due to successive below-inflation pay rewards.
Things have gotten so bad that hospitals, one in four hospitals, are having to set up food banks for nurses and for other staff. This is unprecedented. But we're not just fighting for pay, we're fighting for the survival of the NHS.
One reason for that concern is the number of staff leaving the profession. 25,000 nursing staff have quit the NHS in the past year. The government says the demand for a 19% pay rise is not affordable. The unions argue the money is there. The nurses' strike is part of a wave of industrial action sweeping the UK this year, with the strikers demanding better pay and conditions as a worsening cost of living crisis pushes more and more people into dire straits.
The unions are warning that the strikes this month could be the beginning of a longer period of action if governments refuse formal pay negotiations or if future talks do not result in satisfactory outcomes. Saipur is up, London.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
As they came together for a summit in Brussels, EU leaders were acutely aware that energy storage tanks will run dry in the coming months. There are still major divisions in the EU over a gas price cap and a proposal to buy energy from international suppliers as one single customer.
It is important that we do not outbid each other as member states, but that we use the market power to purchase gas.
It's thought a deal might be finalised on Monday. There are plenty of other divisions within the 27-nation EU. Austria is blocking Romania and Bulgaria from the border-free Schengen area. Meanwhile, funding for Hungary is being withheld over rule of law issues.
Russia is blackmailing us every day. But if we start to blackmail each other, this is not good. And this is absolutely not good for European Union.
A dark shadow of corruption is hanging over the EU. It emerged last Friday that Qatar has been bribing politicians and officials.
This scandal is a very serious matter indeed, which can shake trust in democracy and the parliamentary system. Thus, it is good that the Belgian authorities are thoroughly investigating.
At their summit, EU leaders refused to be drawn on the question of possible sanctions against Qatar. However, they signed off on more sanctions against Russia and also Iran. The leaders agreed to provide at least 20 billion euro to Ukraine in 2023. Campaigners say they should be doing more for their own citizens.
So many people in poverty, like
everything what's going on from the crisis from 2008 until now, nothing changed.
It's clear that things could soon get a lot worse if the EU fails to secure a reliable long-term energy source at the right price. The costly Ukrainian refugee crisis is also growing by the day. So the final EU leader summit of 2022 has now concluded. Analysts say the unprecedented challenges they will face in 2023 could stretch the EU project beyond breaking point. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
While the West is expanding sanctions against Moscow and Tehran over their military cooperation, the potential for developing relations between the two countries is huge, since Russia and Iran are under tough Western sanctions and therefore have little to fear.
The will of our governments is interconnected. Our high-ranking officials and our peoples do not pay attention to the shouts of the entire West and continue to strengthen their ties and interaction.
At the press conference held in Moscow, Iran's ambassador to Russia summed up the outcome of relations between Moscow and Iran in 2022. He noted that Russia's ruble is used in more than 40% of trade between the two countries, and that the Russian currency may become the main one in bilateral trade. According to his remarks, Tehran supported the idea of using the ruble as the main currency in regional unions such as the EAEU. He also referred to efforts to integrate the national payment systems MIR and SHETAP as part of financial and economic cooperation between Russia and Iran. According to the Iranian envoy, Russia and Iran are seeking to reduce the dominance of certain currencies, including the dollar, in bilateral trade and economic relations. Jalali further said the automotive industry and space sector have become another field of cooperation between the two countries. In August, Russia launched remote sensing satellite Hayam into orbit on behalf of Iran.
As for our negotiations, I want to say that negotiations between our respective organizations in the field of outer space are ongoing on a regular basis.
Iran is investigating the possibility of producing cars jointly with Russia. Two leading automakers of the Islamic Republic, Saipan and Iran Hadro, took part in last summer's exhibition in Moscow and held negotiations with the Russian side. In addition to the joint production, the two countries are also discussing the possibility of sending Iranian cars to Russia. Russian and Iranian officials have time and again said that the two countries are determined to further expand bilateral cooperation. They have expressed confidence that the aim will materialize despite all the challenges the two nations might face, given the numerous capacities the two sides have. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Capital Tehran has been host to a forum called the Tehran Dialogue Forum. It's themed to push regional friendship, attended by nearly 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries. The focus was on the policy of the Islamic Republic towards its neighbors and its approach to friendship and trust building. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at Iran's policy initiatives and how the region and the world can actually benefit from the enhanced relations between Iran and its neighbors, minus the presence of the U.S. in the West Asia region and without Israeli interference.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Time to introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohammad Ali Araki joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from London. Also joining us, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Saeed Mohsin Abbas, I will start with you and ask you about the necessity for this Tehran Dialogue Forum in the first place. Taking a look at the platform in terms of what it says, I'm going to put it in a short format so you can elaborate more for us. Platform of interaction and communications among political officials and thinkers, which focuses on the West Asia region in particular. Do you think that this is a forum that is necessary, of course, with Iran being the host?
I think it's one of the most necessary initiatives for that West Asian region that there could possibly be. Because, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been an advocate of peace and regional security since the revolution, without a doubt. I mean, just some examples to show the history of Iran's engagement, this persistent history of trying to create peace in that region. The Hormuz Peace Plan, which was an initiative of the previous government, Iran, which aimed at establishing security, you know, in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. And that initiative was planned to be with the participation of all countries of that region. And that's been really the foreign policy stance of the Islamic Republic. That's the default one. The trouble is that the presence of Israel and the foreign presence of America, because of course it's not part of West Asia. It's a perennial interference in that region, and its manipulation of some of the people within that region and some of the leaders particularly has led to essentially nothing but war, conflict, and plunder and pillaging. This is just on record. We only need to look at the record they have in terms of what they're doing in Palestine as far as Israel's concerned, what they did in Syria, what they've done in Iraq. All of these initiatives, which were a partnership of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, have led to nothing but instability in the region. Iran has always advocated the opposite. In fact, they could argue that it's because of the Islamic Republic of Iran that a lot of these fires that could have turned into huge destruction in that region have changed into a more settled, at least on the way to settling disputes and conflicts. You know, Iraq is one example. Iran's influence there has led to less sectarian confrontation. It's led to the destruction of ISIS, which would have been a nightmare for everybody. Sure. In Syria, we've seen that the sovereignty of Syria was ultimately maintained to the best of the ability, and that was largely due to Iranian backup, I would say. And of course, we can see also for the rights of those oppressed in the region, where of course you can't have peace without justice. And I think Iran has stuck to that mantra as well, and that policy of saying, look, we need justice in this area, and for that, we need to all settle our issues in the West Asian region if we happen to be living here, not allow foreign powers, superpowers, to come in and dictate their agendas, which are usually based on their self-interest, economic interests, and, might I add, the destruction of Iran primarily, and any other Arab or Muslim nation in that region that wants independence.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned this Hormuz peace endeavor, of which Muhammad Ali Araki, I'm going to ask you, this was something that was introduced by the former Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. And it was years ago that he presented that. Actually, he went to the UN with it and talked about how this initiative to bring peace and stability, especially in the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman, is key. But he underlined that this can only be achieved through cooperation and dialogue without foreign interference, and that the regional countries must decide that on their own. Again, this would be in reference to only the two that Sayyid Mohsen Abbas mentioned, which first and foremost would be the U.S. and maybe along with that Israel. Years ago, why is that? Why didn't that have the momentum required? Because we are still experiencing this foreign interference in the form of the U.S. in the region.
Yes, so the interference of the United States of America alongside the apartheid Zionist regime of Israel has been in the region in the past few years, but we have witnessed that, especially since the presence of President Ayatollah Raisi in the Islamic Republic of Iran. He has taken the path down a state of resolving things. We have witnessed a far more diplomatic activity by his government to resolve the problems and end the foreign interference. I personally believe that the meeting that will be happening soon has a big influence in the peace that will come into the region, because the neighboring
countries... I'm sorry, can you tell us which meeting you were referring to? I didn't catch that.
Yes?
Which meeting are you referring to, the upcoming meeting you just stated? I didn't catch whom you were referring to.
By the meeting that will be by the Persian Gulf countries, they'll be coming, and Mr. Amir Abdullahian, he spoke about it today. There'll be a summit, based on what I read, it will be taking place in Iran. Now, I believe that the neighboring countries of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially the Persian Gulf countries, will reach the conclusion that Iran is a true friend for the days of hardship and the good days, and they'll realize, and we can see the change, that the apartheid regime of Israel and its allies are not that true good friend that has always been portrayed on the media. And we have had the different leaders of resistance focus on the fact that, and refer to it, that this normalization of the ties between Israel and many Islamic countries, it's not going to last. I believe this meeting will be a turning point, and it will be a start for the situation changing, and we will be having more peace, hopefully, in the region. And as a result of that, the United States of America and its allies will have to pack up their suitcases and leave the region.
Sure. Well, you know, when you talk about the so-called normalization, Seamus and Abbas, what's key here, and it hasn't really been answered, and maybe you can help us in explaining this to us, is that one of the angles behind and the initiative behind this was to have Israel establish the so-called normalization, try to get these Persian Gulf Arab countries to entertain that, so that the U.S. wouldn't have to be as actively involved in the region, because then Israel's security would be somewhat established by these, well, whichever countries opted to do so, even though it hasn't really been entertained as much as I think they anticipated. Is that a correct reading into it?
I think we're all aware that the nations that we regard as the Gulf Cooperation Council, for instance, whether it's Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, we can name Saudi Arabia within that as well, the UAE. These forces or these entities have been established by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They owe their establishment, the leaders owe their positions of power to the Western powers. And ever since their inception, they've been in the pockets of basically the Anglo-Zionist money mafia. And so essentially, they are tied at the hip with the interests of the West. And they do virtually everything in terms of their foreign policies, and I must say even their domestic and economic policies, which ultimately benefits the West. That doesn't help to really create a genuinely stable, conflict-free West Asia. Because, of course, if you're not interested in your own people's interest in regional trade, in increasing the regional trade, using the energy of the region to help the world, if you're not really interested in having fraternal relationships or even military strategic alliances with your neighbors, that clearly means that you're missing out, for instance, on all sorts of economic benefits that could be there, which go beyond just oil and energy, relying on gas and oil, which is what those Gulf countries are doing. You're also destabilizing the region, and you're spending money on military and weapons, which you probably wouldn't have to. Now, the billions and billions of dollars which these Gulf countries pay to Lockheed Martin and all the sort of licenses for arms and weapons which the Americans and the United Kingdom and other Western countries are lavished with, ultimately benefit the West. They don't benefit these guys. They're sitting there, and every time they run out of these weapons or they get outdated, they go and buy some more. So basically, this relationship of milking the cows of that region has been going on by the West. And Iran is saying, look, you don't need to do this. You can save that money. You can diversify your economy. You can do more trade with your neighbors, especially sure. ourselves. And as a result, there would be prosperity, peace, and automatic sort of harmony in the region. If only they could have the nerve and the courage to step away from their puppet status with Israel, okay. Tel Aviv, with Washington.
Right. Well, that's what I want to ask you, Muhammad Ali Araki, in terms of the most recent visit of the Chinese president to the region, which was to Saudi Arabia. Now, Seamus and Abbas talks about countries like Saudi Arabia that are tied to the hip when it comes to the West, in particular the U.S., obviously. But at the same time, we noticed how important now there's been a turn away, as it's been construed, of Saudi Arabia from the U.S., not completely, but we know the dissatisfaction and the tenseness that exists in that relationship. And it seems like it doesn't seem like it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia is turning to China in more ways than one, in particular when it comes to the oil card. Now, in this case in point, are we looking at a shift there, perhaps, of Saudi Arabia away from the U.S., and therefore we have on the other side of this how Iran is close to China also? So therefore, this both spells moves away from the U.S. Can it be construed that way? Something on which obviously we need to expand on more, because Iran's foreign minister talked about China in more ways than one after this visit. But what's your view on that?
Yes. So as I mentioned in the previous question that you asked about the meeting that will occur with the Persian Gulf countries and that it will result in a shift, I believe that this is also will also result in a shift as well, because the relationship between Saudi Arabia and United States of America has become bitter in the current days, and the meeting of the Chinese official was a very important political message by Saudi Arabia to America and also the allies of China. And yes, we are looking at basically shift of power. And there's also one other thing I must mention, and that is the fact that when this shift occurs, there will also potentially be destabilization in the Persian Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia, because normally the United States of America, when they see that a country is not following their benefits, not in line with them, they would come and cause some so-called organic protests or chaos in the country. But again, the result of this shift, the reason to this shift that has occurred and is on the way of expansion occurring is because of the fact that the United States of America and its allies are truly not trustworthy friends, despite, yes, we know that the United States of America has a policy of milking the cow, but this sure. will no longer work. Okay. And the reason to that is because they have proven that they're not good friends. They are trustworthy friends to Saudi Arabia, despite we completely disagree with many of the policies that the government of Saudi Arabia is implementing in the region.
Sure. Well, we need some explanation from you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Iran vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia in terms of how there are talks that have occurred. Iraq has been the mediator, but we know that hasn't really bore the fruits that perhaps either side wanted. At this point, that door is still open. Even the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, at the Tehran Dialogue Forum, has said that we do want to open up our consulates. But at the end of his statement, he said, if Saudi Arabia chooses to take a constructive approach when it comes to Iran, what are we looking at when it comes down to Saudi Arabia and Iran and the region as a whole, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas?
Well, just in the last month, you can see that Saudi Arabia was involved in most of the social media tweeting, which was inciting riots and violence in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is literally an occurrence that Saudi regime has been essentially part and parcel of the American color revolution destabilization efforts over the last month or two. We've seen that Saudi Arabia hasn't surrendered its policy in terms of oppressing Yemen, even though it was Iran at the beginning of this year whose initiative basically offered solutions, deal to end blockades in Yemen, to stop the war, and to create some rapprochement and harmony for the Saudis and for the Yemenis to get on with their lives without the kind of mass murders and killings that are going on through Saudi bombing, supplied, of course, by the Anglo-Zionist Empire with their arms as usual. So there are two bits of evidence to say the Saudis have shown no real sense of change. Okay, yes, we can take it on board that China has a huge future impact on that region, what with the Belt and Road Initiative and Iran's tie up with them, Iraq has tied up. The Saudis clearly don't want to be left behind, and there's a lot of jostling going on. The Chinese are playing a very wily diplomatic game as well, and they actually came down literally on the side of the Gulf Arab countries in terms of three islands that belong obviously to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and yet China added its signature to the notion of, considering discussions. I mean, those are territorial issues which the Islamic Republic of Iran will not entertain. And if China did that to sweeten up the Saudis so that they would also buy into the Belt and Road Initiative, that's part of China's, of course, need for access to all of this region. But Iran won't buy into those. And if Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries continue to sort of challenge Iranian sovereignty, if they continue to be involved in color revolutions, if the Saudis continue to help finance ISIS offshoots along with the Americans, if they continue to try and destabilize that region with sectarian narratives, because we know that's been a major tool in trying to keep Iran, if you like, isolated. They've tried to make the Sunni fraternity across the Arab world and beyond actually dislike Iran and not engage with them at all. So these are not portents for a great relationship with Saudi Arabia anytime soon.
Sure. Well, I got, I think, four topics that I know we will not fit in the next few minutes left. Let's see. Let me go with Iraq with you on this, Mohammad Ali Araki, representative from Iraq at this Tehran Dialogue Forum said that Iraq cannot be used. He said many things which were actually quite incredible. But basically, we're looking at even the current prime minister of Iraq saying that Iraq cannot be used. Many Iraqi administrations have said that Iraq cannot be used as its soil to be used as a launching pad for attacks or any anti-government activities against the Islamic Republic. Tell us why he would say that, who he is referring to. In this case in point, we know that Iraq has talked about and Iran has actually come out with Iraq against Iraqi Kurdistan and the groups operating out of there, these terrorist groups, they need to put a stop to it. I think they have formed some kind of group that is monitoring those activities. But how important is that? Because that obviously is very important for Iran, and it does contribute to maintaining regional peace and security to stop those anti-Iran activities coming from Iraqi Kurdistan.
So when we're talking about this, we're talking about the national security of the Islamic Republic of Iran and including the neighbors of the Islamic Republic of Iran, because when the Kurdistan region of Iraq is unsafe and is a safe haven for the Zionists and other terrorists, this will have an impact on Iran and the other neighboring countries. So the Islamic Republic of Iran will not give in. And as we saw in the past few weeks, they did not give in. And they were very serious that if the necessary action was not taken, Iran will do what they see necessary. And so thankfully, what we saw was that Mr. Al-Sudani, after the visit he made to the Islamic Republic of Iran, he took the case seriously, and now we witness that there have been troops deployed by the Iraqi government to enter that border in order to clamp down on any potential threats that will target the Islamic Republic.
Sorry to jump in again for lack of time. I got to give Mohsen Abbas the last question here. On Ukraine, so Mohsen Abbas, Iran has said, we didn't want this war from the beginning. We didn't agree with it, that is. And he said that Iran can even provide means for such a dialogue. Coming from Iran, in terms of this summit, the Tehran Dialogue Forum, and its promotion of peace, tell us your thoughts of Iran on Ukraine war, and how can Iran be construed as a bad actor if it's all about peace? In about 30, 40 seconds.
Well, first of all, Iran was part of a message delivery service, if you like, the foreign minister, to the Russian foreign minister on behalf of a European nation, where they proposed a kind of peace deal around Ukraine, or the beginning of discussion around a peace deal. It was intimated that Francis Macron was behind that, but the Iranians participated. If we look at Iran regionally, and this is the summary, really, look, they've tried to help with peace in Afghanistan. They've offered all their services to continue to be peaceful. They've tried in the Azerbaijani dispute with Armenia, peace brokers, in Yemen, in all of the region that they've tried their utmost.
They must continue
their effort and try their best to push this, even though their enemies are going to do their best to break up those efforts.
Sorry, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, fresh out of time. Thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. Mohammad Ali Araki, thank you, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavle and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission.
This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini left Tehran for the holy city of Qom 3 weeks after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He stayed in Qom nearly for 10 months. During this period, people would come to visit the Imam from all over the country. However, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution had to return to Tehran due to heart problem. Today, we will continue the story. Stay tuned, please. As it was said before, Imam Khomeini had to go up the steps to the roof of his house in Qom as people would gather in the alley to visit him. The Imam used to do this several times every day. Thus, he would get tired and his heart would be under pressure. Moreover, Imam Khomeini would receive a number of officials every day. This magnitude of work soon caused him heart problem in early 1980. One day his wife, Ms. Saghafi, noticed the severe pain in the Imam's shoulder and left hand, so she soon informed Haj Ahmad of the event. The Imam's special physician, Dr. Baher, asked for checking up his heart by a heart specialist. Ms. Faride Mustafavi, the Imam's daughter, relates the story. Dr. Baher came to visit the Imam. After checking him, he said that the Imam's heart should be checked up by a specialist. Then he immediately telephoned Tehran, and a medical team was sent to Qom. When I went to the Imam's residence, I saw that Dr. Zargar, then Minister of Health, was there with a few people. Medical checkup was done, and the physicians came to the conclusion that the Imam should be checked up for a few days. Therefore, the next day, the Imam was sent to Tehran in an ambulance and was hospitalized at Tehran's Heart Hospital. The day after, my mother came to Tehran and went to his father's house. Then he went to the Imam at the hospital. The news of Imam Khomeini's hospitalization spread across the country in a few minutes. Thus, a big crowd of people gathered in the streets around the hospital. The medical team asked the people to pray for the Imam's health and immediate healing. People gradually left the area as they had become sure of his health. But the enemies spread rumors on Imam Khomeini's demise or his suffering from an incurable disease. Meanwhile, in spite of the physician's recommendation on absolute resting, the Imam delivered a very short speech, which was televised and broadcast on TV. This short speech ended all rumors of enemies. Fortunately, Imam Khomeini gained his health with the efforts of doctors and the prayers of people and left the hospital. The medical team said that the Imam should reside near the Heart Hospital to be under surveillance. Imam Khomeini accepted the recommendation, although he liked to return to Qom. Therefore, a house was determined in Darabad neighborhood of Tehran, but due to people's frequent commutation and the medical team's presence, there were disturbances for inhabitants of the place. Thus, another place was proposed for the Imam's residence. Haji Ahmad and the daughters of Imam Khomeini saw the house and accepted it as it was adjacent to a Hosseiniyeh, which was a suitable place for public meetings. The Hosseiniyeh was called Hosseiniyeh Jamaran. A few days later, the household furniture was transferred to the new house. Hosseiniyeh Jamaran was half-built and it was full of construction materials, but it was completed with the people's effort within 4 days. In mid-May 1980, people decorated the street to welcome the Imam. Imam Khomeini came at 7 p.m., while a big number of people had gathered there. After entering the house and looking at the rooms, the Imam said, "Now I am comfortable, as I was under pressure for 4 months." The new house was small, but the Imam liked it. At 8 o'clock, the Imam said that he was ready to meet the people around the house. Therefore, the first public meeting was held at Hosseiniyeh Jamaran. A few days later, the VOA said that after a few months of searching, a place had been determined for Ayatollah Khomeini, which is immune against any air raid. The next examinations revealed that the Imam's residence was suitable in terms of security, as it was beside mountains and surrounded among tall trees. Although the Imam's wife would complain about the size of the rooms, the Imam told her, "This is a good house. Those who come here will know that this is your house."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.